name is Ben. I'm the CTO at BitGo. And so BitGo is like an exchange API that many exchanges like Bitstamp, Corbit, and Upbit use for their wallets. So we do scalability and security.
Cool. Yeah, my name is Jake Craig. I also work at Coinbase. I'm senior software engineer on the crypto payments engineering team. So we're the team that sort of runs all the blockchain integrations at Coinbase. If you do sends or receives, hot wallet, cold storage, all that kind of stuff goes through our systems. Yeah, been working there for a bit, and it's all right. On Ethereum.
Cool, and I should probably introduce myself as well. So I'm Eric Scrivener, and I'm also on the crypto payments team with Jake at Coinbase. And he did a pretty good job of summarizing what we do there, so I'll leave it at that. And all right, so we'll start with some softball questions here. All right, so this one is one of my favorite ones. I think this should be asked more at Ethereum and DevCon events in general. So if you were an EVM opcode, which EVM opcode would you be and why?
Well, I'm on stage in 2018, so I think I have to be the PC opcode.
Fair enough. All right. What about you?
This is interesting because I actually looked up the opcodes recently.
There's quite a lot of them.
Yeah, no, I'm interested in what he's going to say. I can't have a guess. Anyway, my favorite opcode is call.
All right, I can see that. Oh, yeah, and the why?
Why?
Yeah, what do you enjoy about call?
Because I think it's what makes Ethereum so interactive
Okay.
Expandable.
All right, fair enough. And Jake, which one are you going to be?
So I've got two. I think the first one might be what you're guessing. There is an opcode called Coinbase, which is a very convenient one. But that's not going to be my choice. My choice is going to be XOR, which it's just because, all the new cryptography stuff in Coinbase, in the community coming out and stuff, it's just XOR powers basically all that at some level. And it's just a really exciting thing to play with. And it's this very simple thing, but it's just so powerful.
All right. No one picks self-destruct. Okay, that's good.
That's yours.
All right, that's mine. Yeah. Okay, so let's kick things off. Let's move on to the medium ones here. Okay, so I really like this first one. So what is your biggest challenge integrating with Ethereum at this moment? Start with you.
Yeah. Okay. One huge challenge is nonce management in terms of you can have rapidly fluctuating gas prices across the network, and if one transaction gets stuck, then it slows up all the others, and you either have to resend the first one or just wait it out. That's a huge challenge.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think we see that as well. It's a pretty common issue when you have very large wallets. So with large wallets, and when in Ethereum, as many of you know, the accounts have a nonce, and whenever you create a new transaction, it has to have a nonce which is monotonically increasing. And the way that it was designed that way is because it's a lot easier to track, and it's for double spend protection and all that. And so say you're running an exchange or something like that, and you are going to be sending 10 transactions per 5 minutes, and this can be, 100 transactions, over 50 minutes. And if at transaction number four, you put in a wrong gas price, then by transaction 50, all your transactions can't clear because four isn't cleared. So I think that's a big challenge there. Do you want to talk about some solutions?
Yeah. Yeah, like you said, we've all sort of had this issue, and it is one that tends to come up at scale as you're doing just a lot of them back-to-back, right? If you're an individual wallet, you send one transaction. If it takes a while, maybe that's okay, or you can really easily sort of replace that. There's this sort of replace by fee mechanism. And it's an interesting one because, it sort of depends how you structure your hot wallet as well. There's different ways to do it. Some exchanges, tend to use a sort of single or a few addresses for everything, so they have a lot of transactions going through that address. Other ones use, contracts and stuff, or, lots of them. Like Coinbase in our wallet, we just basically have just, hundreds of millions of addresses, and so we always have it all over the place. And so when we hit the situation, it can be fairly limited in scope, but it can affect a subset of customers. And there's not great solutions for it yet. Other than replacing it, which is a solution, but it's a more sort of complicated one to manage, and especially when you've got a lot of these going on. And so this thing where sort of the gas prices can spike, and sort of delay everything is really challenging. This example that I've seen in our systems before is, you know, transaction 2 minutes apart, same gas price. One took 2 minutes to confirm and the other took 13 hours. And that's not a really great way to build, you know, systems and to build a business on Ethereum. And so it doesn't just affect us. It could just affect a business doing this who doesn't have, you know, as sophisticated infrastructure to handle. And one of the things that we've sort of talked about and seen come up but a few times is, you know, this idea that comes from sort of Bitcoin of this child pays for parent style of transaction, where it's a similar mechanism of sort of recovering sort of pending ones that are like chained together in some ways. Like in this case, it's chained by like the nonce. It's different in Bitcoin. But the theory is sort of you put a new transaction out like on top of all these with a high fee, and then that sort of can subsidize the rest of the lower fees and get it back to closer to what the real network fee is. So miners will pick it up, and they'll pick up all of them at once. So you just send this like transaction with this really high fee, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're maybe, you know, 50 whatever transactions are all can get confirmed, and you can sort of recover that and have sort of a better experience for your customers. So that's an interesting one.
Yeah. So let's talk a bit about that. So firstly, you know, RBF like replaced by fee, it works today because it's, you know, you can do it yourself. But one of the larger I think confusions with that, you know, when you change the fee, you also change what you're signing, and therefore the TX hash gets changed. So if you're displaying a TX hash, a TX ID to the customer of the person receiving the funds, then it will be different. With CPFP, it's, you know, well known in Bitcoin land. The common challenge is, you know, the idea is you have 10 transactions not confirmed, so you put another one, transaction 11, and it's got an outsized fee. And the outsized fee helps to tell the miner that, hey, you know, if you want to get this outsized fee, you got to mine all these other 10 first. the challenge for the miner then is how are they going to figure out that this string of 10 transactions combined with the 11 is really worthwhile for them to mine. Because if they were to do this infinitely, like after 1,000 and 1,001 transactions, then they can run out of memory just waiting for you to come up with another big, you know, fee.
Yeah, that was the thing that was brought up. It came up in Ethereum maybe a few months ago now when there was this exchange that was sort of incentivizing lots of volume on the network. So it was just kind of backing up the network. I think this is another sort of big challenge with Ethereum is that individual token sales, individual just new, you know, games or whatever can like significantly impact the network very, very quickly and very fast. They start the token sale, the fees skyrocket. Now everybody in the network's paying more. Any app you built is just now all of a sudden paying more. And then now you also, as you know, anybody sending transactions get them stuck because the estimate can only update once it has all the new data. So you're kind of at this, you can't ever predict it necessarily. You can have some sort of models, and like generally it works and it updates fairly quickly, but there is this sort of delay. And that was a thing brought up when it was started to be talked about in Ethereum a little bit. I believe on the Parity repo there's an issue that has some sort of proposed model, but they're specifically talking about sort of like DOS vectors and stuff with this, like how long do you track it, what's this buffer, and is that configurable, and how does that actually work?
So to summarize here, it sounds like volatility of fees is the biggest challenge here, and there's no good solution at this point. Is that the deal?
There's a solution. It's just a challenging one. I think because like Ben said here, the, you know, transaction hash changing and stuff, it's a more complicated thing to like match things up. If you have sort of two pending transactions with the network, and one of them will confirm, and generally it would be the higher fee one, but like I think in theory, like the lower one can also confirm. So now you have to have these two sort of states, and like, all right, which transaction's real? And then, you know, one of them will confirm. And so it's just a more complicated problem to implement.
It does become a potential challenge, too, because it's even like child pays for, or parent pays for child, and it's could potentially, okay, so now we have, and you kind of touched on this, Ben, where maybe miners run out of memory space when they're waiting for all these pending transactions. Maybe like if hypothetically that did exist, if it was implemented poorly, it could lead to this new design pattern where everyone's putting, you know, 1GWA or whatever it be as all of their transaction prices, and then if it doesn't clear within some X time period, then they put out a transaction to kind of clear those out. So we have this now almost waves of transactions going through just because people want to pay, lower their costs, right? So it's a tricky situation.
All right. Okay. Well, it's so all three of you seem to have consensus on this.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the things, right? I think another one that's not just us, but I mean, we definitely experience this is just running notes, right? Running notes, keeping them up to date, the size of the backups and stuff. In particular, the sort of like archive state notes that store like the full history. I think Offrey of Vienor Parity just released a website about like that constantly tracks the size. And so if you run like Parity, you can get it to like 200 something gigabytes. But you don't have this sort of full history one. And that one tends to be, I think, around these days 1.8 terabytes or something. And so just the size is the thing of just transferring that over the internet when you need to like spin up a new one just takes a lot of time. I think our ones, when we spin them up, are like 3-4 hours right now to sort of do that. Yeah. We've got things to get them faster, but...
A fresh sync is like, I think the last one I did took about a month and a half, something like that. Which kind of flows nicely into the next question, which is, do you think that integrating with Ethereum is getting harder at that low level that we're talking about here? And if so, do you think that we're at some sort of critical juncture with respect to that?
I think for instance, I mean, the blockchain size keeps increasing every day. So for that purpose, it is getting harder in terms of resyncing nodes or syncing a new node. If one crashes or something like that, you lose the database. In a lot of ways, though, there's a lot of tooling that makes it a lot easier to integrate things. So things like Truffle or Ganache are becoming really, really easy to use, and there's a great user experience around dev workflow now for even just for local development, but also for production. And it's this interesting kind of duality. So some parts are getting harder, in my opinion, some parts are getting easier potentially.
I think to go to production with Ethereum is getting a little bit harder. I really like the developer on-ramp. So, you know, the developer tooling and all the you know, building tools are getting better and better at welcoming new developers, and that's why we have so many developers at this conference. I think that so far as running a node, when I last fired up, a node for myself, you know, we have lots of nodes in production, but sometimes you want to hack yourself. I think Geth, if you're running in the fast mode, it's actually not too bad. And I think it's right now it's not a critical juncture because at this point the block processing time is still less than the time it takes to propagate and the time that a block gets found. And that we can talk a bit more about that. Like that was different earlier this year. But I think that right now it's quick, where you can fast sync all the way to the head of the chain, and then you can just, your blocks are getting processed quick enough with, modern hardware. It's not totally a problem. And of course, you really want to be running a proper archival node in production and running several of them, so that's a different challenge. But to get onboarded, I think it's actually still pretty easy.
I agree that, like, onboarding definitely doesn't, and there's a lot of really cool stuff there to like get up to speed and like start being able to do things. But like you said, sort of at this sort of like scale thing, or when you're running like businesses that are worth a lot of money and a lot of money's moving through, you also want to like have sort of the full history yourself and always have a copy of that. And so this kind of initial sync time, while like I think for a lot of use cases this is not particularly important, or like syncing sort of every block into sort of your own database so you have sort of your own full history that you can analyze outside of just the sort of latest state. Like one of the things we have is our data team wants, full copy of the blockchain in, SQL that they can sort of analyze and do things with. And right now, so we sort of manually build tools that do that kind of stuff. And just takes a while, right, to just because of the pure size.
Do we know how big that is? How much data that is?
No.
It depends on how you want to index it.
Right.
So I think there's this project I saw part of the grant team showcase. It was called Vulcanized DB or something like that. It was pretty cool. You tell them what you want to index, and they will run it through and put it into a Postgres. I think it's a great idea, and it's
nice.
It's lowering the bar so that not everyone has to build an indexer. You guys probably build an indexer, and we have an indexer. So everyone's building one, but the more that it can be open source, the better.
All right, I've got another easier one for you. Well, maybe it's not easy, actually. It could be easy all the way to hard. So Parity or Geth? Or Aleph, if you like that one.
I'm partial to Parity. I found that it's been more reliable and faster sync has been nicer, and we can get into the whole Parity trace parsing issue, which I'm sure we will.
Yeah, yeah.
But
we can definitely hop into that. That's definitely one advantage Parity had early on.
Yeah, well, that's what I've heard is with Parity. What we're sort of hinting at here is this idea: if you're on Etherscan, you see contracts sending Ether around. They call them sort of internal transactions, and sort of detecting those and seeing like where money moves is a complicated thing. I actually gave a talk on this yesterday. That there'll be a recording of and stuff about sort of the ins and outs of how that works and stuff. But from my understanding, I wasn't around when this happened, but Parity was one of the first ones to give an API that made that more like accessible and easy to sort of figure out what happened. And Geth now, I believe since 1.8 it was, does have an API for this too, but it's not a standardized API. It's actually a custom one for each one, and so there's no standard way to process these, and that's, I think, something that would be really interesting to see in the future.
Yeah, it's interesting because like there are lots of transactions that happen that appear nowhere in the blockchain, right? And so I think that's one of the interesting differences between Ethereum and a lot of other ones. But Ben, what about you?
Yeah, so the first question, I think both, Parity and Geth.
Okay.
Run them both. Depending on what the network situation is, sometimes some of them have challenges processing certain types of transactions and blocks, and some of them, then the other one goes faster. And so I think running both is the way to go.
All right, fair enough.
I think that this is a huge topic, internal transactions. For us, it's one of the largest pain points. So at BitGo, we use multi-sig wallets. These are wallet contracts, smart contracts. And for us, when we send out from the smart contracts, we want the receiver to be able to see the funds easily. On more modern exchanges, they do, record the deposit because they can look at these internal transactions. And so a little bit about internal transactions. So in Ethereum, you have transactions, and transactions are what I think are the first, you can call it like the first hop, in which an account sends something to an address, where the address is either a contract or another account. And the challenge is after that, if you send it to a contract and tell the contract to do something, then internally the contract is making changes to state and doing internal messages, some of which may be sending funds, like Ethereum, to other addresses. Now, the challenge with that is that currently in the Web3 API, there is a GET transaction, which does the first one. It shows you all transactions that come, from accounts to smart contracts. But usually what a multi-sig wallet is that you would send a transaction from one of the signers to the multi-sig wallet, and then the multi-sig wallet would then send out the funds from the smart contract. And that is a smart contract transaction or internal transaction. So there's no, RPC or API to easily get a hold of those transactions. As a result, some of the exchanges, they don't recognize deposits automatically for such smart contracts. And this, I think, will be further exacerbated because now we're moving towards, unified ID wallets?
Mm-hmm. Universal login. Yeah,
universal login wallets, which I'm a big believer of from a UX standpoint. But remember, they are also smart contracts, so we need to solve this problem, as an industry and make more people actually take in deposits from smart contracts, because that's what Ethereum is about, right? It's the smart contracts.
Yeah, and it's a scary thing to process these too. You can have some pretty dangerous sort of bugs that come up from doing this the wrong way, and so there's plenty of exchanges and stuff who don't want to do this yet because it is this sort of scary thing to get wrong. Whereas transactions and stuff are fairly straightforward to kind of tell what's going on. These aren't, so it's a big risk, and especially as we move to more and more sort of wallets doing things, and these are going to have to be supported, and we need to make that easier.
Yeah. That kind of flows nicely, actually, into the next one that I kind of wanted to throw out there. Morgan, did you want to go? Okay.
It's probably going to the same place.
Yeah. All right. So I guess the next question would be wallet contract or... scan individual blocks and transactions and invoke transactions. Which one do you prefer?
Yeah, so why? That is exactly where I was going with that. There's pros and cons, right? So either you're generating a new address for every deposit you want to take as an exchange, and you have to monitor these internal transactions very, very carefully. And you have to sweep them into your hot or cold wallets, and it's this big process, or even... as a contract side of things, if you build things as a contract, I think Bittrex does this and maybe some other ones too. Things like sweeping gets easier. You can monitor events in your smart contract, so internal transactions aren't a problem anymore. But now you have increased cost for each individual customer who needs to a deposit address but may never deposit any Ether in there. You have to handle tokens as a completely separate case, and it definitely complicates things, and there is that trade-off.
Yeah, one of the things I don't particularly like about wallet contracts, especially if it's like a single one, is that it puts all your transaction history in one place. And privacy is a really important thing and we want to have, and so contracts, especially this, and because of the costs, like you're going to be incentivized as any sort of business to do sort of one, right? Unless there's some extra cost or something for, you know, a new address. And if you have one, now all of your history to that exchange is in one place. And so anybody wants to see how much Ether you had and how much you sent there, they can now tell that, and maybe how much you have in that exchange. Maybe that makes them more of a target. If they follow a pattern, like things like Bittrex's contracts, like you can detect them easily. And so you can easily see how much Bittrex is receiving through that pattern. Whereas like the way that we do it, which has some other downsides and costs, is like we generate new addresses just all the time. Like almost any time you get an address from us, it's a brand new one that's never been seen before. If we send transactions, it's coming from a new address that's never been seen before. Clearly that has some things of just having a lot of addresses, that's its own problem. And I think we might get into that later too about, you know, sort of batching transactions and stuff and doing a lot of sends. You have some interesting challenges there, internal transactions, but I think, like, I don't like this idea of just, like, linking everything together, all of your activity in one place, especially if you're going to, like, send from there, too.
So, I think in terms of having one address per client, I mean, per customer of the exchange, pretty much many exchanges are used to this concept from, you know, a variety of other digital currencies. And so, I think on that matter, what we're doing is whether or not you're a contract or an address, you got to have one address, you know, one address per downline, you know, customer deposit address. And so what happens in the end is that when you try and do that with contracts, you're probably going to be using some kind of forwarder contract, in which what it is a really small shim that forwards the money from this unique deposit address for each customer into some main wallet. You know, sometimes the challenge with that is with us at least, we want it to be a multi-sig platform. And so we wanted, you know, all our wallets and contracts to be, you know, not controlled by a single key. And that was one of the requirements that we set out to fulfill, and that's why we did it that way. I think that, I mean, one advantage of that for us that we, I guess, haven't talked about is that with contracts, you know, instead of looking at the internal transactions by yourself by looking at transaction receipts, you can look at the events because you can get contracts to fire events. And actually, you can do it within the 21,000 gas limit. You can get one event or something like that. Barely enough. And then you can code your indexes to pick up those events and use them for, you know, deposits. So there is one advantage there. The disadvantage is, you know, you have to pay the gas to deploy the contract, which can be very costly. I think there are some EIPs that are out there that are not too far away from being landed that will allow us to do, you know, basically pay to script hash. In other words, you can pay to an address, which is a contract address, without actually it having been deployed yet. And then someone else can then deploy it after they see that, oh, okay, someone actually deposited there. And this is really useful in the case of an exchange that has, you know, 100,000 users and only 50,000 may use ETH. So you only need to set up the address after they deposit.
You did bring up an interesting thing there, I think, about like the gas limit stuff, right? So this is a thing that different exchanges have to make different decisions on, of customers sort of sending Ethereum somewhere, and if it might go to a smart contract, if it might not, and the trade-off of like what sort of UI do you present there, what sort of gas do you charge your users, because, you know, your standard Ethereum transactions are flat 21,000, you can sort of guarantee that, whereas you send a contract, there's no guarantees necessarily. There's things that you can estimate it, and it's probably right, but it might change too. There's some ways it could. And like that's an interesting thing exchanges have to do. Like us, on our sort of brokerage of just Coinbase.com, you don't see any gas stuff when you send, and that's a very like intentional decision to keep it simple, because it's a very confusing UX sort of design pattern, as I'm sure people have talked about in the design tracks here. And it's this interesting trade-off of like how to handle that, and as like a business, how do you set that and how do you sort of expose that to your users?
Yeah, it's an interesting question for exchanges and, I mean, Coinbase, you kind of both, but both exchanges and wallets, really. Same UX problem, really. It's the same UX problem that all of Ethereum and really all of the cryptocurrency industry is kind of going through right now.
Yeah, it's probably not just Ethereum, but we can't really just sweep it under the rug. I mean, the main issue, I think, really, is that customers are expecting to pay, you know, they're used to paying, you know, fees which are a percentage or a flat fee. And in Ethereum and other chains, you're really paying for compute or space. And not only that, it's an auction of block space or compute.
Interesting. All right, so I think, Jake, you had mentioned batching briefly down there. Do you guys want to maybe chat about that a bit? What do you think about it? Is it something that Ethereum needs? Is there some sort of alternative thing that maybe would also be interesting to have?
Yeah, I think I only first brought up, we were sort of talking yesterday, and I sort of brought this up, and I hadn't thought too much about it deeply, but like I mentioned, we have a lot of addresses, and so we have all sorts of customers sending in all sorts of amounts, so you know we'll end up with a lot of addresses with very small amounts of Ether. And we'll need to, so let's say we have a set of addresses that have, you know, one ETH in each, and we need to do, you know, 10 Ethereum sent. Well, we need to sort of combine those into some other address. And then after that confirms on chain, all, you know, 10 transactions that might take, we need to first send 10, wait for them all to confirm. Then once they confirm, we can then send out this 10 Ether. So this, we call this like consolidation internally. And this is sort of a complicated thing to manage. And it's an interesting thing because like Bitcoin and sort of these UTXO chains, they have a different way of approaching this that doesn't have this problem. And so once you, one of the reasons they do that is so you can have sort of a new address for every sort of change at amount. And so you can basically always be using new things. Whereas like on Ethereum, it's really hard. And it's all about this privacy stuff again, where you wouldn't want to do that, because if you wanted to do a send, you'd have to do all these like intermediate sends to finally be able to do it. And so I think it'd be interesting to consider some sort of like batching strategy or like multi-transaction thing where you could say, you know, from all these addresses, I'll include all the signatures for them, do all these transactions at once into some like destination and have sort of one atomic send there. Because also you probably don't want to do, because you could also, I guess another way, instead of consolidating and then doing, I think, a 10 ETH send, you could do like 10 individual 1 ETH sends to that destination. But if it's like a payment service, they probably aren't going to handle that well. If they're expecting 10 ETH and they get like 10 1 ETH sends, they're not going to know where it's supposed to go to.
Right. Pretty bad UX if a user goes to send one transaction and they receive 10 on the other end.
Yeah, that's probably going to confuse them. I think with Ethereum, actually, it's pretty cool in a different sense that in Bitcoin, you know that you have these unspents, and you can tell whether each unspent is economical to spend or not. In Ethereum, you can almost say, like, okay, if you got like some dust, you can just wait, because remember, you're not spending per unspent, you're spending from the account. So, you know, if someone sent you a lot of, you know, one ways, you could wait for, bazillion of them before you actually took it out. Usually, I think, you know, consolidation is a good idea to just do it, like, when the network is less loaded. So, you know, when nobody's holding any ICOs, well, right now, not many people holding ICOs, but on weekends or something like that, when the gas price is pretty low, and keep it low so that you don't actually impact the network, because you very well could. One of the interesting things I want to ask both of you here, you know, what have you seen with regards to batching out outgoing transactions? So, you know, with other coins, and without getting too much into that, a common pattern is you wait every 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and you batch out a send, you know, of whoever else is trying to withdraw during that time. With Ethereum, this has largely not been done yet, even though it is very possible even today without making any changes whatsoever to consensus or at all. You can just use a smart contract and do a multi-send.
Yeah, for me and like some of the conversations we've had about this sort of thing on Ethereum and Bitcoin, really any chain, is this privacy again, because like you now link all your sort of customers together in some ways, and we want to generally prefer that. Like, we like to sort of default to privacy and try and maintain that as long as we can. And so when sort of batching comes up in that, that's always the thing that, like I mentioned earlier, about like wallet contracts, like putting everything in one place. And maybe just Ethereum's the wrong chain for the types of things that I'm talking about. And I think there's ways we can get there. But for me, I haven't seen it. And you can definitely pull it off, like you said, with smart contracts and stuff.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the Ethereum, for lack of a better word, purist answer to like the batching question is, well, why wouldn't you just use a smart contract for that? And that's kind of Ethereum's answer for everything, which isn't a bad thing, but maybe there's trade-offs that you don't want to make there in your server-side architecture that we spoke about earlier.
If you have a wallet contract, I guess it becomes very convenient to do these kinds of multisigns. But if you don't, then there's no like alternative mechanism, right?
Yeah, you could theoretically design a function call in your contract that would multi-send to a list of addresses that you pass in.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
And it's all technically the same Ethereum address, but then they just happen all in the internal transactions. Right. But then, like you said, they're all linked together. And
well, you also need a balance. That's not what you want. You need a balance on that account, too, that's like sort of public and probably associated with you in some way. So, like, it depends how you structure your hot wallet, but, like, you don't want to probably have all your money in one place. I mean, maybe, but...
Yeah, right.
It's the thing to think about.
Essentially, lots of exchanges end up with a hot wallet somewhere.
Right.
And I think for Shapeshift, it doesn't matter as much because you do like one transaction at a time, right? So you'd like to send that. But maybe one of the reasons why people don't use this as much in Ethereum is like, I think Ethereum people are really used to seeing a transaction where they have a source and a destination. And if you look at that, like on Etherscan, you know, it's quite clear, right? It's always got a source and a destination. So it's very one-to-one in how people, like the mental model of how they think about a transaction. You know, in other chains, you always have multiple outputs.
Yeah, it's also, I think, a little less necessary in Ethereum. Because, like, we talked about the non-stuff earlier. In Ethereum, you can do these sort of serial, but, like, back-to-back sends, like, from a single account, right? If you just increment the nonce, you can continue to, like, send from the same account. So you can queue up all of them at once without any sort of delay. Whereas, like, on Bitcoin and that style of chain, you have to sort of, if you have a big sort of input of, you have to sort of wait for that to do its thing and then do another one. Or there's other ways you can do it, but it's a lot trickier. Whereas like Ethereum is just like, just keep sending from the same account and it'll let you do it. And like, it should generally work. And it hasn't been too much of a problem we've seen where like any sort of need for batching yet either. I guess there's some like gas savings potentially.
Yeah. I think that like the gas savings, I think that with Ethereum, maybe we aren't as mature yet with doing gas optimization. You know, with Bitcoin, for example, because things were so expensive, you wanted to save every little bit you could. So you're paying the same amount for signatures on the inputs. And if you can send to 10 at once instead of one at a time, you do that, right? But with Ethereum, I think it's still a little bit early with the gas savings now. It's mostly like, how do we price the GUI, gas price rather than actual gas spent.
And really, all of these conversations change once like an actual Casper sharding, some scaling solution gets implemented. They're all just completely different because we have a whole new set of problems. And
May not even I can't even imagine what that would be like with a sharded network. It'd be much more complicated. I think we might switch gears here a little bit. What do we got here? I guess I would love to talk about privacy with you guys. So, how are you thinking about it? What do you think the status of privacy and fungibility is in general? Are we there yet? What are some of the interesting prospects? And how do you trade that off with scaling?
Well, I would say that in terms of Ethereum, we're definitely not there yet for privacy.
Okay.
Definitely not there yet. But it's like snarks exist now, but it's really not easy to use unless you have PhD, and even then it's difficult. It's definitely tricky, and really their best implementation should be in some sort of plasma-like implementation or in a shard of some kind. So it's almost a catch-22 in that which comes first, the scaling of the privacy.
Yeah, so I think it's not there, not by any means. I mean, you can see how easy it is to track, you know. I think on Etherscan they have labeled like Shapeshift 1. There's an address there which shows you know where you do your transactions through, and that's the most public thing I've ever seen. Having said that, I mean I don't feel like you can really trust the so-called pseudonymousness of Bitcoin, you can always almost think about it as those transactions will be revealed. When you think about privacy, it's not just about like privacy today. And okay, maybe it's a little bit hard to track today, but the blockchain is forever, right? So you going forward like 5 years later, all of that data is going to be there. So you're going to have to live with whatever you're putting on there today. So I think that security is really important, and privacy is one of those important things for security, because it makes it just that much harder to secure something if you have a very big target, amongst other reasons. So I just don't see this as something that is being worked on enough yet from Ethereum. I think that we have scalability challenges, and I think they're going to go after those first, because that is what drives adoption. I mean, whether you like it or not, they want to drive adoption now.
Yeah, I'm really excited for sort of the prospects of like the future of privacy, but I don't think Ethereum is doing maybe enough to be concerned about it, there's definitely teams in the space working on sort of off-chain sort of style solutions, which I think could be really interesting. But just the general sort of blockchain community as a whole, there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on, right? You know, there's all the Zcash and such doing all the snarks, and then there's, you know, Starks now, and, you know, Bulletproofs, and all sorts of things happening. But I think you brought up a really good point, Ben, about like this sort of like foreverness, this sort of infinite sort of data thing. And this has already happened with Monero, where, you know, they had some sort of bug where you could, in theory, sort of, I think in some ways you could, I don't know the details, but you could effectively like sort of de-anonymize some of their transaction history because of some sort of, you know, vulnerability there. And that's sort of already happened. And so in a lot of this new cryptography, it's also new. And, you know, most of the cryptography we're using is like fairly like well-established, tested and stuff. And so we do these, you know, security audits, but a lot of it's also still backed by this there's a word for it, but this idea of like it hasn't been broken yet, and a lot of people have tried. We can't prove it's totally secure, but we think it's pretty good, and so we'll keep using it until then. And a lot of the newer stuff I imagine would have like similar properties, except it doesn't have like, it's not battle tested in that way. And so while there's like really smart people doing it and developing this stuff, I think that's a really like big sort of risk in general to it. But I think it's definitely a worthy goal that we should go for as, you know, businesses and anybody wanting to build on this. You know, I don't want my whole history to be for everybody to read. Anytime I send somebody something from any of my, you know, Ethereum wallets, they can potentially see my whole transaction history. And I could split it up into all sorts of addresses and try and do that, but then it's like that problem we described earlier, even on like a just individual level, not even the exchange level of, well, that's really complicated to manage. And also expensive, just fee-wise.
Cool. All right, so another easier question here, but what are you guys most excited about with respect to Ethereum?
That's a good question. I would, like, as a something we would like to see in there, or as a...
Yeah, something you'd like to see, some project that you think is interesting, or some, you know, future prospect that you're really looking forward to.
I definitely think that, for me, it probably goes back to the whole nonce thing that we kind of started with. That's one huge pain point, and some solution to that, even at the protocol level, would be very nice. It's also something that Jake mentioned yesterday when we were chatting, it's very interesting concept of, because we have, it's more of a solution to the internal transactions parsing problems that we've had, where maybe we could implement events at the protocol level, like contract type events at the protocol level. And I hope I didn't take the one you were going to say just now, but...
No, I think, it's a really interesting idea, like, this, like, because I think it's a good way, because, like, events are this, like, known entity, and people know how to deal with them because of ERC-20 and 721, and they're going to, you know, continue to be used, and people will have tools and stuff around processing them in really interesting ways, and so I think that would be a really nice way that you could, you know, extend, you could bring these sort of internal transactions out of this sort of mysterious world that you need to parse to get them, and I think that's one way.
I think it's a great idea. I mean, when you look at it, what a lot of people actually want is they want to see when Ethereum moves. And there are a lot of ways that smart contracts can send that today, which don't get shown up with the GET transaction API. So I think events are one of those ways. If you can fire those events whenever any ETH moves, that's a big way that will make it easier for integrators to see these transfers and credit deposits. Another way, you know, could be give them what they really want, which is a get transactions API, which actually gives them the transactions of all F. And you know, that's easier said than done, but, you know...
I don't even know if it's that hard, right? Like, we've all sort of experienced this parsing of these traces. Like, it's a doable thing. I mean, it'd be really easy to, like, write a tool that does this. Like, it's not so much that it's, like, difficult. It's just that it's just kind of... There's all these nuances that don't seem to be really documented. And so, like, various... node implementations could absolutely implement these APIs, especially ones that have sort of custom ones. But I think what would be ideal is like a standard sort of RPC API that wouldn't require like protocol levels, because I think that's going to be a lot harder to sort of sell. But you could absolutely just have an API.
Yeah, you wouldn't need any protocol level changes at all. We wouldn't need any consensus changes. It would be a new kind of RPC API extension to Web3 or something like that. And I think people, you know, from someone that for us, because we care so much about platforms and having developers use platforms, you know, if they have to go for a talk like yours, which also, you know, great talk, but if they have to go for a talk in order to learn how to do it, that's probably too hard. You want to just give it to them right away. Just give them the API and it should do what they want.
While we're on the topic of things that I would love to see nodes implement is I believe it already exists in the EVM as far as I know. I think it came with Metropolis is the returning data with a revert opcode, being able to have actual error codes I can send back in my errors and not have to do extremely tedious solidity debugging for hours to find out my typo.
So there was there someone working on that? I think there was a talk about that, right?
I didn't see it this time. I'm sure there was.
Yeah, trying to standardize the return codes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So,
I know they implemented in Metropolis the opcode to actually return just arbitrary data, like you can pass a string to revert, but I haven't heard anything for standardization.
Yeah, I think there's someone working on it. I think it's really important. I mean, it's like kind of like you have HTTP status codes, you should have return opcodes.
Yeah.
Yeah, one other thing I think is interesting that would be cool to see, it doesn't exist, but it's like some more sort of infrastructure or sort of tooling around like running nodes and running nodes in sort of like a high availability setup, right? A lot of the nodes of today sort of expect you to run them in this sort of single configuration of just you have one thing running on one box and you expect it to never go down and never break. And that's just not reality, right? Every piece of software will break at some point and will go down. And so if you're have a lot of sort of transaction stuff going through. Also, you can't just use one. Like, it just wouldn't work at the sort of scale you may see. And so you need more than one, and then you get into all sorts of issues where you make a request to one node through a load balancer, and then you make another one, and you get a different result back because it hit a different node that's a different part of the blockchain. So you have to sort of deal with this in like interesting ways, whether or not you sort of take data from multiple nodes, put it in your own database, and sort of handle that inconsistency there, or I mean, just run one node, I suppose, is an option. There's a lot of choices here, but there's not much information on that, and I think other blockchains have other like proposed ways of running them in more of this like high availability setup for like if you want to build like you know reliable sort of infrastructure around these to make sure that you know nodes aren't your problem and you can just kind of focus on the chain. I think we need some better tooling there.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a great grant project actually. I mean, think about it, right? Like, because we have, like, I think Ethereum is really cool. We have, like, the most clients, I think, of any blockchain, probably, most different implementations. You could almost be, like, connect to the Web3 of Geth and Parity and be, like, a load balancer across both and only accept things that both of them agree on or come up with.
Yeah, we have an issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have, like, an interesting setup that kind of does that, but not about the agreement thing, where we actually sort of chain them together. We chain together different node implementations so that if there is some sort of consensus breaking rule in one of them, it'll sort of stop there and not sort of get to the rest of our systems because like these things happen and this is a way to sort of mitigate them. And so, trying to sort of detect consensus and detect like 51% attacks and things like that, there's probably a lot of interesting tools that can be produced out of there that I think a lot of exchanges and companies building are doing on their own, but there's no sort of shared stuff out there.
That's actually quite interesting, but also risky. So when you look at like consensus breaks, sometimes what people do is they attack one of the implementations and cause it to, you know, maybe see a block as invalid when it should be valid. And you know, the safest way, in my opinion, is to connect to both of them and then see if there's a substantial difference in the two chain heads by a significant amount of work, right? If you chain both of them, it's actually good in that you, well, kind of good in that you get the most valid one in that both of them will see it as valid. But there could be something out there that has more hash power that you don't see as valid.
Right. Yeah, it gives up liveness, yeah. Right? In the event of a chain split, it sort of gives up liveness instead of like just keep running on and like hoping you're on the right side of the chain. It says, we're just going to stop and we're going to figure out what's going on here and we're going to investigate it and then attempt to make the right decision there and catch up or whatever we need to do. But I think, a great point, though. That is the sort of trade-off it makes to do something like that.
We're going
to
stop the world and until we figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. The world's weird when that happens. So.
All right. I think I'll do this last question, and then I would love to do some audience questions if we have them in the last 10 minutes there. So we'll do an easy one, which is what's your favorite thing about working with Ethereum versus the other cryptocurrencies you've worked with, Morgan?
Obvious answer: smart contracts. Right? It just offers so much more that you can do, so many more interesting, creative solutions to a lot of the problems that aren't specific to Ethereum necessarily. Things like it does offer its own share of problems, but and really just the community. Like there's a huge community around Ethereum and building this out that does make it never a boring day, right? Never a boring day. It's always interesting. There's always something new happening. It moves so fast that you have to almost struggle to keep up with it sometimes. That's a good problem to have.
Yeah, I think that the community in Ethereum is this, for me, one of the strongest one. It has, I think, one the most developers, which is a great indication for me as an engineer of where it's going to go. I think that in general, you want to build, when you build something, you want to see like other people are using it. So there is adoption as well, and you feel more welcome building something on Ethereum. It's like, hey, I built this, and everyone likes to try it, see what kind of dApps you built. And I really, I really enjoy that.
Yeah, I think that's a big part. I think, similar answers for me is, what people can do with smart contracts, like I don't really do much work with them myself, but to see what people are able to produce, especially like all the recent sort of financial instruments and stuff, things like DAI existing and, the ability to be able to create some sort of thing that has a stable value without anything actually behind it is this really interesting concept, or all the stuff people are doing with, the relays and all the variants of, loans and all that is somehow happening in this world. And it's kind of crazy that that happens. And you can just very easily go on to some, some wallet app and instantly, take out a loan or something. And that kind of works. And then the community is, also really, I think, generally healthy community and doesn't have as much of the sort of tribalism you might see across all different blockchains. There's, some of it, of course, as there is anywhere, but generally I find that the community is very sort of open and willing to work with other blockchains and stuff and try and push sort of everything forward. I think like one great example is this was the talk yesterday on verifiable delay functions that they're talking about doing in Serenity is this it's this thing that's not specific to Ethereum. Like they're actually bringing in other chains and want to work on this together in collaboration and come up with this just better cryptography and better system to, have this, new concept work for everyone and not just be this like singular thing for Ethereum. Like it's, our baby and we'll just, keep it here and nobody else can have it. And they're just like, let's share that with the world and let's, make it all better because it's so early days and all this stuff. There's a lot to figure out. And I don't know who the winner is going to be. Maybe we'll all be winners. Maybe none will be. But we want to, all just work together and try and be healthy and get there.
All right. Okay, so we'll open up to questions if anyone has any. All right. I'll just hop down here with this microphone and hand it to you.
So you guys are on the front lines. I think you'll have a really good perspective on this. I'm curious which projects you guys think belong on-chain. Kind of where you draw the line for that. And, as assuming that we improve efficiency and scalability and stuff, do you guys think that will change, and if so, how?
Yeah, I'll talk first, I guess. I'm conflicted there. Sorry, I like on-chain just because it's sort of this singular place to integrate with. The title of this is Integrating with Ethereum. And it's, as we've talked about, it's already sufficiently complicated. And the more things we add on top of that, especially layer two things and various protocols, it becomes even more complicated. So the sort of onboarding cost gets a lot more expensive, and it's not as easy unless we build tools that can somehow do this. But if you know now some new protocol comes out that, you know, all of the exchanges, all of the wallets need to integrate, and you know, you scale that up, you know, to multiple different ones, that's going to be fairly difficult. And so keeping it on chain, you know, has some nice guarantees there. It just simplifies it overall. But clearly that has sort of, you know, scaling and limits and stuff. And there's a lot that can be done off chain and maybe, you know, published there as just some proof. And I think there's also a lot of value in that if we can have, you know, really good sort of second layer solutions to pull it off.
Yeah. So I would give it, like, I think there's a trick answer to that, because you said on chain. I think like side chain right now is the best. Because you know, with side chains, with checkpointed into the main net, you kind of get a lot of the advantages there of being on-chain, and that it's really easy to integrate because people can see Ethereum transactions and you've got an EVM on the side chain. So you can run quite a bit there, but it's not going to scale eventually still. I mean, a single dApp could still take up, you know, all the gas on its own side chain in the end. So, but for now, I think where we are at, that's the best we have, and it's going to get us there until 2.0.
Yeah, I kind of see both sides of it. Like, for simplicity, doing it all on just the main Ethereum chain is definitely the easiest way to keep it simple, and for scalability purposes, it's definitely nicer to do it on a side chain of some kind. There's, I think, some kind of balance there. I would, at the very least, I think anything that should be, anything that's considerably expensive, I mean, you can, like, CryptoKitties, anything that clogs the network or is sufficiently expensive or has sufficient network should be in some sidechain or shard or something off the main chain, of course. Anything more simplistic that maybe either doesn't have traffic or, like, I'm not sure if it makes sense for, like, new developers coming in after, like, 2.0 drops and stuff like that, should jump right into, oh, yeah, we're going to develop our thing right into a sidechain. This is my first dApp is on Plasma, and it increases the barrier to entry for Ethereum, which is one of the things that makes Ethereum so great in my opinion. So there's a balance there depending on each individual app.
All right.
So I think your moderator asked a great question earlier about what was your favorite feature of Ethereum, but I'd like to ask the opposite. What is the biggest pain point that you as scaling Ethereum developers deal with? I know that, Morgan from Shapeshift, you mentioned earlier that dealing with the lack of return codes was a pain point. Is that the biggest pain point? What's the worst part about dealing with Ethereum at scale?
Well, so I think there's really two sides of that. Is there's the solidity side and the smart contract, and what's a pain point of dealing with those and that whole ecosystem, and then the server-side architectures and integrating addresses, or do we choose a wallet contract? Personally, doing both sides, yeah, error codes is a huge pain point for me. It's a huge time sink trying to debug issues there when you have essentially two, maybe three error codes that all basically say the same thing. It's definitely a pain point.
I think it's the internal transactions challenge where other people are not viewing them easily for me, because that you don't have much control of yourself. No matter how much time you spend yourself, you're not gonna get someone else to accept the transaction which they can't see.
Yeah, I think there's a few. I think, like, that's a huge one that's like prevents people from sort of getting onboarded and getting there. I think there's things we can do that will make that easier, and these are things that, like, eventually once you get them kind of working correctly, well, you know, they do become not so much of a pain point, but they're hard to get right the first time. Things that we see, like, you know, regularly. Oh, I'm going to say two things. One thing we see regularly, not much recently, everything's kind of died down, but all the gas price stuff. Like, earlier this year, all the time, gas prices spiking, things get stuck, and that's a pretty big pain point, and we don't currently have systems on Ethereum that sort of automatically recovers that, and we talked about some ideas earlier that could help with that. The other one, that's more of a rarity, but also similarly for, like, building these sort of high-volume systems, if you have to start tracking these nonces and stuff yourself. And if you get one out of order, you're in a really weird spot, because if you're doing, like, multiple sends for customers there and you, like, skip one, now you have, so if you have, like, four or five, six, and you don't do five for some reason,
you've got a hole.
You've got this hole, and so the other one's just going to be pending forever until you fill that in. And like, what if you like, I don't know, retried something else and then you send another transaction. You can't cancel this 6 now. Like, it's out there. And so you have this weird, like we can't introduce like canceling transactions. That would be like not really possible. But that sort of thing of like calculating these nonces, like you can't, because you're not just using a single node, you have to sort of track that yourself and make the right decision there. And so that's a challenge to like do right. And then when you get it wrong, specifically going too high, going too low, the node will reject usually. It just depends where like your node's synced at. But going too high creates this thing where it's like, oh yeah, now what? And you don't know how long it's going to last. It's in the mempool. We had a thing once where, you know, we filled in the gap and it went out. We didn't expect it to. And it's like, oh, well, I mean, it was okay, but it's not a fun thing.
All right. Any other questions out here? All right. We got one way at the back. I'm going to run. I know.
You guys talked a little bit about better standardization for like your server architecture or smart contracts themselves, air quotes. Where do you guys feel the governance process is for that? Are you guys talking one-to-one to each other, or is that on EIPs, or kind of like how do you have those conversations together in the industry to get stuff done?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just
good question.
One thing real quick on that. Like, that's one of the reasons why we wanted to put together this panel, is to get people talking, get people talking public. I think there's a lot of sort of secrecy. A lot of things are shrouded, and they shouldn't be, and there's no real reason for them to be. But I think we all approach things different ways. Like, if we were to talk about how we all run our nodes or how we all do not stuff, I imagine we'd all sort of do it differently. And there's things to learn from each other there. Like, I've already learned things talking about, you know, the contracts, the different trade-offs there, and the way they do things and the way we do things. And I think the big thing is, yeah, at least get people talking. I don't necessarily have an idea. I think the best place to do that, there's definitely, you know, some, you know, just every now and then you talk with somebody or reach out. But I do think it would be really cool to see more sort of open spaces to discuss these things, and especially with sort of, you know, like big participants in the network being able to contribute to those conversations. Maybe. I think it would depend on the company, because I think also companies like to do a lot of sort of protecting of their information too, and that becomes sort of challenging. But I'm curious.
It really is like all open conversation, and yeah. It is kind of segmented, that conversation right now, whether it's Gitter or Stack Exchange or conferences or GitHub issues. There's tons of places where a lot of the same conversations are happening, so I don't really know of any centralized place where this is all happening as of right now. But it is all about really conversation and just seeing what other people are doing. This is a very new space and we're all kind of just figuring it out. And a lot of things you almost have to learn from either experience or listening to somebody that did get the experience and made those mistakes already.
I do think like it is interesting because it is the thing like I don't think people talk about enough is sort of the types of problems we were talking about today. I think a lot of the people working on the protocols and stuff tend to be very low level and close to there and have, you know, specific ideas around how people are going to run nodes and stuff together. But I think that, you know, at sufficiently large volumes, you have to do it differently. And I don't know of a space where people really talk about that yet. So I think definitely ETH Research would be an interesting place to sort of discuss that, or Ether Magicians or any of the sort of forums like that.
All right. We got one quick comment here. So. Just another vote in favor of just some sort of central group chat. I don't care the venue, but when I'm having issues with like all these like holes and nonces and sending transactions and like all that stuff, just if we can find some central group chat where I can ask you guys a question, that'd be really nice. So thanks.
So there actually are a few, but at the same time, when they get too large, then people start leaving and start tuning out. So it's a challenge. What level of noise you want to be at and how much, how public it is.
Yeah, I think it would be good for us to do blog posts or something about this.
So we've only got 30 seconds. I know the panel's out here. But to end on an interesting note, it sounds like there's a lot of challenges from a developer point of view. I know that's what you engineers love. But why are you here? What's so exciting about you to be in this space in 5 seconds?
None of the challenges are insurmountable. And we're seeing the want to scale and the want to get better here. And I think the community is great, like we were talking about, and that's why I'm here.
Yeah, that, I mean, for sort of the privacy and sort of ownership of sort of your own funds and, you know, all the sort of developments there are, like, fascinating to me. All the sort of talks today about all the privacy and all the cryptography and stuff is interesting. I think it can just lead to a lot of, you know, good in the world and people sort of, you know,
having all control. All right, we gotta kind of wrap it up here. Morgan, if you want to 5 seconds real quick.
Brand new set of problems to solve that haven't been solved before. And we can solve them together.